Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, sexy pants. Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 260. Over at the Nerdist YouTube channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. We have a bunch of new stuff going up. There's a season finale of Cop Skyrim, Nerd Turns, Just Cause from Gallifrey 1, the Ben Folds video, Baba Booey, a lot of fun stuff. It is a digital party over at the Nerdist YouTube channel. So go to youtube.com/Nerdist, click subscribe, because I asked nicely, because I should use an adverb there to... Or I can talk dirty like, yeah, friggin' click subscribe, you bastard. And then I'm no good at that. I am no good at digitally grabbing your hair and forcing you to click subscribe. So back to the nice guys. Please. Also, you can support the Nerdist Podcast by shopping at Amazon through the link on this episode of the Nerdist Podcast page at Nerdist.com. Go to find the graphic on the post that says Amazon.com. It was designed by our friend Dana Lechtenberg. You click on that, and you shop for things that you would normally buy, whether it's, I don't know, protein bars or Swiffers or extra tubes of toothpaste. Maybe I'm just listing things that I've purchased recently because I have to buy travel sizes of everything, and I like to have a lot of it on hand. I have a cabinet full of travel size things. It looks like the travel aisle at a Rite Aid because I'm just a guy on the go, people. And in keeping with that, I am in New York right now, and I just podcasted today. These two guys, Rob Burnett and John Beckerman. Rob Burnett is the executive producer of The Late Show with David Letterman. He's been with Letterman since 85. He started on the show as an intern. He's worked there pretty much the entire time. John Beckerman also writes for the show, was head writer as well, and really great guys. And like being with him is like being in the writer's room. It's such great stories. And they also wrote a movie together called We Made This Movie, which is now available on the iTunes and other digital platforms where you might buy quality entertainment. So check that out. They talk a little bit about that in this episode, but just really terrific guys. And this was so much fun and so informative. And I believe you will enjoy this. Even if you don't know these guys by names, you certainly have been influenced by their work. And for guys who have been on a show that long, they're not like cranky or bitter. They're just super nice, happy guys who have great jobs on one of the most iconic shows in our culture. So here it is, episode number 260 with Rob Burnett and John Beckerman.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Feels like you're going to the doctor, doesn't it?
I just need you to relax.
Everything you're doing, you're plugging things in, pulling things out.
I just need you to just let
the
this
little
happen.
Comments too. Like, yeah. Looks good.
It just has
looks
that
good.
Feeling.
All right. Oh, that's not good. Listen, you don't have to be anywhere, do you, for the next year?
You don't have family.
Well, you're going to want to contact your lawyer. It's just a precaution. Don't worry about it. Well, thank you for having me here in your offices here at the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Thanks for being here.
It is a pleasure to meet you.
Huge
Likewise.
Fan. I spend 45 minutes in my car every day 90 minutes if you count both ways.
Oh, my God.
2.5 hours if some idiot runs out of gas on the West Side Highway listening to your show. It's amazing.
Well, thank you very much.
I work from home, so I've never heard the show. But no, it's not true.
And is that going to continue with this episode, or do you think you're going to give it a shot?
I might check this one out. This might be the one that does it.
Okay, yeah. Good.
No, I also listen to and enjoy the show, so we can get that out of the way.
See, for me, it's the opposite. I remember I was on Mates, Tom Cavanaugh and Michaeline Black's, a Nerdist property.
Yes.
I want to get into that, because when I saw that, you're now taking over the podcasting world.
One podcast at a time. My tiny corner of the internet.
Yeah, and that was odd for me. So I bullied my way onto their show as a guest.
Yeah.
Because I love it. And then inadvertently ruined my commute because I ruined their show by being on it. So then I couldn't listen to that one. So then it was like, it was horrible.
Can you not listen to yourself?
Well, if I'm funny, yeah. So, no.
Oh, shit. Good. Well, it's nice to know that even in your position, you're still just as critical as the day you started.
Hey, we're all in comedy. We're all idiots. We're all insecure. We know how it is.
No, God, absolutely. I guess the day that you're like, yep, I got this comedy thing figured out is the day you should really...
Yeah.
Introduce yourself and tell everyone what you do.
Hey, I'm John Beckerman. I've been a comedy writer for like 20 years now. I got started on the Letterman show pretty much right out of college in Dave's last year at NBC. And like 2 weeks later, Rob, who's sitting next to me here, became the head writer. And so we've been collaborating on stuff for many, many years now, including, you know, besides Letterman, the TV show Ed that ran on NBC for a few years.
I didn't hear the end of that from my dad. You know, my dad was a professional bowler. And so my dad was like, you should have made Ed. And I was like, Dad, just because there's a bowling element to it and you were in bowling doesn't mean that I'm going to be involved with every bowling-related endeavor. Right.
Meanwhile, like, I'm lucky to break 100 bowling. So it wasn't exactly a passion before the show.
Yeah, no, he was right.
But yeah, so, you know, that, of course, is how we got to know Mike and Tom. And... then, you know, we've done other stuff since. We did a show called Knights of Prosperity that I think is best known now for being the show that Sofia Vergara did before Modern Family.
Was Kevin Michael Richardson in that? And
yes.
Joel Logue?
Yes.
I love that. And
thank
was
you.
Was JP Manu in that?
No.
There's a big poster right there. There's
everybody.
There.
It was Maz Jobrani.
Oh, Maz. Yeah, Maz. Yeah.
Yeah, that was super fun. It was just one of those shows that I think... had, you know, it was just an uphill battle figuring out how to market it. And, well, that may be a story for another time, but it was great. I mean, we had always dreamed of doing something with Donal, who we had known for many, many years. And he came off Grounded for Life, and that sort of became our opportunity to write something for him. And then that brings us to We Made This Movie, which Rob and I wrote together, and I produced as well. That's who I am.
Time to write a movie in the middle of making a daily television show.
Well, you know, I've been concentrating a little bit more on stuff for Worldwide Pants on the outside. I mean, we have a tremendous team here that kind of does the day to day. So, in the last several years, I've been focused largely with John of trying to do. You know, really ever since Ed, trying to develop other stuff. So, for us, this movie was, it was great. It was kind of like doing a TV show, except you didn't have to do 22 hours of it. You know, that's always the trick of television where you make this pilot and everyone likes it if you're lucky. And then it's like, oh, here's 20, the analogy we always use, we always say, what if Woody Allen had made Annie Hall as a pilot for television? And they would have said, wow, this is unbelievable. All right, we need 22 hours of this.
But don't you feel like every Woody Allen movie is another episode in that sitcom?
Maybe so, but at least, he doesn't have to write all of them within, an 8-month period.
And shoot them each in 5 days.
I always love this question where they go, you pitch something, they go, great, what happens in season 3?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Space?
Yeah.
They go to space.
My answer is, it's going to suck. Because even if Woody Allen had done Annie Hall, episode 7 would have been, you know, the crappy episode where they go back to his high school reunion. You know what I mean?
Episode 9 is the clip episode.
Exactly. That's
remember
right.
Remember the time we were
locked in a meat closet? Yeah, we were locked in a meat closet. We couldn't get out.
I think that would... That's the next thing someone's gonna do on YouTube is basically create the flashback episode of Woody Allen's
I think
sitcom.
We just wrote an SCTV sketch from 30 years.
I know.
Rick Moranis.
Moranis, of course.
Doing Annie Hall the series.
So Woody Allen, you got your Catherine O'Hara out there.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Let's get those kids together again. What do we need to do?
Andrea Martin was a guest on Ed. That was thrilling for us.
Oh, I loved Andrea Martin.
Yeah, it was thrilling.
I had a weird dream last night. Maybe you can tell me what it means. I was trekking through this weird area, looking on a map, trying to get somewhere, and I kind of ended up in this snowy, mountainous region, and I saw this old man come out of this area, like this hole in the side of the mountain, and then he saw us and got scared and went back in. I couldn't even describe who I was with. So he goes back in, and all of a sudden I recognize him as Johnny Carson. I see Carson, and he's really old. And basically what I've pieced together in my dream is that he faked his own death for some reason, but that he's actually still alive after all these years.
Yes.
And he gets kind of wistful and starts talking about, you know, that maybe it all wasn't so bad, and he was, you know, and then he agreed to do the podcast to talk about it. I was like, I can't believe I'm going to get to drop this on the world, that I've discovered Johnny Carson living in a retirement home dug into a snowy mountainside.
This was the exact plot of the movie Prometheus. It's so weird.
Oh my god, that's right! Johnny Carson is a prequel to Aliens! Oh, I totally forgot to remember that.
Johnny Carson, in your dream,
yes.
is the future.
He is.
Yes, he's the future and the past.
Okay.
So you, by doing podcasts in your mind, you are killing Johnny Carson.
Oh my god.
That's what this is.
I've death of the old media.
I've resurrected him to kill him.
Exactly. Well, you're killing old television. So what Johnny Carson was and can never be again
is alive.
Chris Hartwick
okay.
is responsible for.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Oh my god, I feel so good now about that dream. I was just confused by it when I woke up.
Yeah, whatever you need. We're here.
I felt kind of good at the same time.
Well, you got to see Johnny Carson.
I did get to talk to him. Never met Carson. You must have met him.
I did, and one of my fondest, show business experiences, the one, you know, one that I will treasure to the end of my days. we used to go out to the Emmys every year, back when we were being nominated for Emmys, we'd have a dinner. We'd have a staff dinner. So one year, Johnny came to this. So I find myself at a big, like an 8-person table with Dave, Johnny, and a bunch of other people. Johnny is very socially awkward. Dave is socially awkward. they just are. I think they both would admit that. Johnny seemed socially awkward in your dream, frankly.
Right.
He snuck back into the hole.
Even in the ethereal afterlife.
Yeah. Dave around Johnny is always a thing to behold, because it's the only time I've ever seen Dave kind of intimidated by someone. It's kind of interesting. You know what I mean? His feelings and idolization of Johnny Carson are very apparent.
Yeah.
So we're all sitting there, and there's, you know, 7 or 8 other people. So some woman comes over. I think she was maybe Wolfgang Puck's wife. I may have that wrong, but anyway, she comes over, and she now starts making a huge deal of Dave. She had met Dave somewhere, and she stands there and she says, "Oh my God, we met in an elevator," and she's very imposing. And she goes, "And I just kept thinking, I can't believe how big you are. You were so big. You were so much bigger that." And it was this crazy thing, right? So all of a sudden, in the middle of this, Dave is completely now tied up with this woman. I don't know how this happens, but Johnny, who's sitting across the table, and I'm sitting 2 seats from Johnny, we look at each other. And Johnny looks at me, I look at Johnny, and Johnny just goes, "Oh, he's big." I somehow find the courage to go, "Oh, yeah, no, that's a big man. That's a big, big man." And this woman's now talking to Dave, and Johnny Carson and I begin just tooling on David Letterman together. So it's like literally the two of us going, me saying, like, where do you suppose a guy like that buys clothes? You know, and Johnny go, I don't know. It's impossible. He's gigantic. And it was one of those, and Dave could hear this and was kind of getting a kick out of
but
it.
But there's nothing he can do.
No, because he's tied up with this woman. But it's just one of those things where, you know, we all have them. If I had ever looked into a crystal ball when I was a kid and thought there's going to come a moment where Johnny Carson and I are going to be making fun of David Letterman, you know, that's it. I'm done.
Not only that, but just to be locked in a bit with Johnny Carson.
It was amazing. It was just the greatest. And he really was enjoying it, kind of. And it just, it's one of those things that I will, you know, if nothing ever else happens to me, I'm fine.
I actually heard a story that that's the only time he ever made contact with another human being with the eyes. He never looked another person in the eyes.
I'm sorry.
No, you go.
No, I was just going to say, I don't know if you remember my story from this event.
I do.
Is this something I could share in a podcast?
That's up to you.
I will, because I'd like to have it, you know, as part of the permanent record, I guess. So I was probably like 24 years old at this thing and an idiot. And I just decided that I was going to touch Johnny Carson's butt so that that's something I have done in my life. And I, you know, in a very subtle way, when he was standing talking to somebody else, I kind of acted like I was brushing, you know, squeezing by him, and I totally got a handful of his butt.
Did you cup it or did you use the back?
I didn't squeeze it. Like, I wasn't going to squeeze it and have him whirl around and stare at me. I just touched it. So, like, I pressed my palm against it. And I'm not saying that was an awesome thing to do, but it happened, so now...
It is interesting that you have one hand that it looks like a baby hand now that never aged.
Yeah, withered. Yeah, it just withered and dropped off.
What? And he didn't notice?
No. I mean, I assume he didn't notice. I don't know. We never discussed it.
Hey, remember that time I...
You may not remember me. I cupped your butt.
Turn around. Tell me if you remember this.
What? No, I used to do stupid things without thinking about the fact that they could have an actual impact on my life and career. I think in the way that young people feel like nothing bad can happen to them. Similarly, probably on this same trip, I was in the audience of the Jay Leno show, you know, with a couple other Letterman writers. And he was doing an audience piece where he goes up into the, you know, talks to people in the audience, and you can see yourself up on the monitor if you're on camera. And I was that guy who clowns, you know, in the back row when the camera's on Jay. I was like, you know, doing the little move where, like, you're right on the edge of the screen so you can pull your head out and then back in.
Of course.
And then out.
It's a classic.
And then back in.
A classic.
And and of course, somebody I knew who was a writer on The Tonight Show, I learned, pointed this out to Jay. And, you know, that's a Letterman writer.
Oh.
And I was just completely terrified. And there was a moment there where it was like...
What's he going to do? Run you over with $1 million car?
No, it was just like, what if this is a thing? Because, like, you know, at that point, certainly, I mean, it's very different now, but at that point, the shows did not acknowledge each other and did not diss each other, like,
yeah,
in any way. And there I am from the Letterman show, like,
yeah,
basically ruining his segment.
Did you get a phone call from Jay?
No, but I did have this thing where at the Emmys, there's always this thing before the show starts where people just mill around in the, you know, 80 degree heat in their tuxes and, you know, out front before the thing starts. And I made eye contact with Jay, and he totally knew who I was and gave me, like, a, you know, the sort of point and a wink thing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, from how it was explained to me, honestly, I think Jay just thought it was funny and didn't care at all.
Hey, you want
to
touch my butt? I heard you touch Johnny's butt. I'll let you touch my butt.
I love how I'm presenting myself in this thing so far. I'm a moron.
Yeah.
I'm just a moron.
That's the meaning. So let me say, am I being fired for disrupting Jay's show or cupping Johnny's butt? I just need to know.
I just want to ruin my career with The Tonight Show in some way.
Yeah.
I don't care. You know,
this was all 20 years ago, though, so I'm cool.
Maybe I should should slap Doc in the balls. I don't know, just something. I think we should do something.
Slap Doc in the balls.
By the way, let's just talk about the Bill Pullman bust you have in your office.
Yes.
That says, William J. Pullman.
Yes.
Today we celebrate our Independence Day.
Yes.
What, I should probably get a picture of that before I leave. Why,
well, this is from the movie that John and I have just made together, that we wrote and produced together, called We Made This Movie. We have our giant premiere tonight, although there's no time frames on this podcast, so it was awesome, or it's going to happen, or whenever you're going to post this, you fill in your own time frame. But for today, it is we have this big premiere in New York City tonight, mm-hmm. And the movie is about these five kids, high school kids, who decide we're going to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
They have no prospects. They live in a horrible town, and they say, "Hey, we got computers, we got video cameras, we can do it." So they set out to make kind of like Jackass,
yep.
But they're terrible. They have no idea what they're doing. They're not fearless. They're not funny. They can do it, but they shouldn't be doing it.
So Jackass minds everything about Jackass.
Exactly. But the trick of our movie is that the main character, filled with adolescent hubris, is so convinced that this thing is going to be huge that in the second scene, these three freshmen show up with video cameras, wearing these ridiculous hats that have hidden video cameras. The other character is saying, "Who are these guys?" Well, I've got them. They're going to document this. We need the DVD extras, and we need the making of our movie. So these three freshmen follow them around and shoot every last thing that they do. And what happens is, as the movie goes on, these other cameras start capturing their actual lives, and you realize, they realize, and the audience realizes, the movie they set out to make is horrible, but the movie that we have made, they've accidentally made a very touching coming-of-age story about themselves.
Is it scripted, or is it...
It's scripted. There was a lot of ad-libbing, but it is absolutely scripted. So, getting to your question, their big plan of how they're going to release their movie, Bill Pullman went to their high school in this fictional town of Buckstown, New York, and he is a whale in the tiniest of ponds.
Of course.
So, in their high school, there's a statue of Bill Pullman.
Yep.
And all they think is, we've just got to get this movie to Bill Pullman, and once we do that, we're just going to go buy butlers and yachts. Like, that's all we need to do. And so even that is such a foolhardy plan. I mean, Bill Pullman can't even get a movie made himself, and God bless him. He's a great actor, and he was fully in on the joke, and he, you know, has a great sense of himself, and I love the guy. But that just shows sort of how misguided these kids are. So that part of the storyline is them tracking down Pullman and, you know, trying to get him the movie and what
happens.
Why
want Pullman to be president?
You know what? He's just sent me an email yesterday where I think he's back on TV playing a president.
Listen, Reagan was an actor.
Yes.
He became president.
Yes.
Why is it crazy to... I mean, Reagan didn't chimp movies. Why is it crazy that the guy who was in Ruthless People and Independence Day...
And we made this movie,
could not be the executive branch of the government?
He sent me a press photo of this new show he's doing. I don't know what it is, and it's him looking presidential, and I just thought I would vote for this guy.
I would vote for Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, if I ever get to be like a crazy billionaire, I'm going to do shit like run Bill Pullman for president. Because it really...
Yeah.
Listen, this is a soundbite headline news...
Yeah.
Banner culture, he wouldn't even really have to have much of a platform.
You're
as
right.
long as you could plant the right sound bites
yeah.
and the right headlines, he'd have a pretty good shot.
He'd get at least 16%.
So that's why I need to make $1 billion in the next 4 years.
How's that going?
Well, I just started,
okay.
so
All
it's
right.
not it's not going well yet.
Okay. All right.
But I feel like I could pull this off.
So at this point you're under $1 billion.
I'm somewhere
under $1 billion.
I'm just south of $1 billion by a lot.
Okay, all right.
But I feel
should we start a Kickstarter for Bill Pullman's presidency?
Good idea.
Oh my God.
I like
that
it.
That would be amazing. That's not a bad idea. That is really not a bad idea. And I'll just set the date for 4 years.
Right.
And I have one question in this. Do we need to consult Pullman on this or no? We just maybe
who the fuck wouldn't want to be president? if you were able to just hand deliver it,
that right there is in the movie of this. That's where we cut to. It cuts from me saying, "Should we consult Pullman on this?" to a scene where then this is already happening and Pullman's sitting there, and you are saying, "Who the fuck would want to be president? What do you mean, Bill? Why are you mad? What do you mean?"
It cuts to Bill going, "You go. Should we consult him?" And then it cuts to him going, "Do you think you should have consulted me?" And no, Bill, come on. You got to get out there. It's a debate. Because this could skate past his consciousness for a while.
Yeah, I think so.
And then so if you could just hand deliver and go, "Listen, Bill, this started out as a joke."
Yeah.
Or future Mr. President, as we should call him. But we've raised, you know, $400 million so far. And it looks like this may actually happen.
I think we got a chance,
So I really feel like we have a chance.
I think so.
It's a quick question. What are your political beliefs?
Oh, shit.
You want to bring slavery back?
I know.
What?
Oh, man.
All right. Let's just keep that, you know.
I also feel like we should send all foreigners back to their country. Oh, Jesus.
This is the actual
research segment, by the way, that you're doing there. Yeah,
oh, you just got to...
You just go down a little bit. There's a little bit of swag.
We
went out for
that.
Pizza with Bill Pullman. We shot in New Haven, and they have the best pizza, you know. And we went to Sally's.
Charming. I like this. He's got a local pizza joint. Oh, this is all for the campaign. Does he play an instrument?
He will. His double will.
The flugelhorn.
Yeah, no, but we sat at a table and they're eating pizza with Bill Pullman, and it was fun listening to Bill Pullman eat pizza and just be like, this is some good pizza. Now I feel like I'm doing Paul Giamatti now.
That is a little Paul Giamatti.
You do it similar.
Can you do Bill Pullman?
Abigail Adams. I do Bill Pullman eating pizza?
Yeah, I shouldn't have tried.
Ah, this pizza, the crust is fluffy and delicious.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
And the cheese just slides off the top with ease.
I feel like you must have been there, because this is exactly what it was like.
I think, you know what we should do? Here's my idea. So to get around whatever his political beliefs are, we'll just record Bill Pullman talking about pizza and remove any reference to pizza. And just have the descriptors about
America.
Healthcare or America. We'll replace pizza with America.
I think there's a chance that on that night when we ordered so many pizzas, he might have said I think there's something for everybody.
This is genius.
Like, that's perfect.
Here's the movie. It's sort of a Bowfinger thing.
It's Bowfinger.
Where we shoot Bill Pullman and he thinks we're just hanging out, but we're actually building the platform and we're seeding him to answer things that we can then re-edit.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that Bill Pullman does not have the internet or a television, so he wouldn't be aware that any of this was happening.
Yeah, and I think the act three, or maybe middle act two, that's when we find out that he has crazy, like, Nazi-like political beliefs. And we have to deal with that.
And then it becomes springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, and now we've got to do everything to not get him elected, right? Yep. But he's taken it too far.
Well, that's when we run Danny Aiello.
Yes.
Against him to try to dive bomb.
I like this.
Or Danny's the running mate.
Yeah.
I think Danny Aiello's the running mate.
This is right here the opposite of a think tank.
It's just a tank.
Is
Danny Aiello alive?
Doesn't matter.
Because that makes it even more hilarious.
There's a Weekend at Bernie's element. Yeah. We run a dead Danny Aiello. We run for president.
Right, but years ago dead.
Right.
Danny Aiello.
So we stuff Danny Aiello and run him for president. That is a movie we could sell.
With CG technology and some editing, we could absolutely resurrect. I should really find out if Danny Aiello is alive, and I feel really bad that I don't know that.
I think he feels bad that you don't know that.
It's
a bigger problem for him that you don't know that he's alive.
And then you never know. Like, someone put on my Wikipedia page that I died yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
You look fantastic.
And they hadn't even heard this interview yet.
They didn't even know that this was going to happen. So while we're consulting the internet as to whether or not
I think Danny Aiello is alive.
I believe he's alive.
I think
as
we
well.
Would have heard that. That's the kind of thing where you'd be like, Danny Aiello died.
Still alive.
How old is he?
Really?
79.
Perfect. He won't even know what's going on. This is fantastic.
There's no reason he couldn't be vice president.
But I do like the idea of running a dead guy now, because I think the Weekend at Bernie's element, I think, can make this over the top.
Yeah. Now, is there any, like, voodoo element where when music's playing, it comes to life, and then we have to stop him from dancing around the stage during a debate?
I think that's too unrealistic.
Okay. That's what we're going to suspend our
debate. I like to keep it
we'll
real.
We'll lose people.
Yeah, I think so. I think people will be like, no.
I'm a big fan of Zombie Aiello, vice president. And then halfway through, he attacks the other vice president.
Yeah, he eats the brains of... the debate is him eating the brains of the other guy.
Whoever it's going to be, Biden or Ryan or whoever it's going to be in 4 years. This is good.
I like
this. Listen, I came up here just thinking we were going to talk about the business. And in fact, we've crafted an amazing...
We all have our next project.
...cultural tale.
Yeah.
That someone is going to start this, by the way.
Yeah.
Someone is going to do the... Why wouldn't you throw up a weird Kickstarter and just say $1 billion? Can you do that?
You probably can.
I guess, because if it doesn't fund, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Right.
What if you get, like, what if you get, like, 990 million? Like, you're so close, but it's not going to fund unless you hit a billion.
Yeah.
And you probably, you think Dave would kick the last 10 million in?
I absolutely think he would, yeah.
He could do that.
Yeah, I don't. That's pocket change for him. He wouldn't even miss it.
I love the idea of just now actually being more serious and going back to when you're talking about how Johnny was an awkward guy and Dave is an awkward guy. I have some understanding as a comic, like, oh, on stage you can be all comfortable and loose and take anyone on, but then off stage you just can't communicate with other people face to face.
To clarify for Dave, I don't think Dave is awkward personally. I just think in certain social situations, certainly with Johnny Carson, you know, I mean, that's, you know, such a huge part of his life. But I think I think Dave is not comfortable being a celebrity. There's some celebrities like Regis, for example, who loves being a celebrity.
Right.
He lives near me in Connecticut. I've run into him in the supermarket, and honestly, literally, he is Regis at all times.
I'm not going to be surprised if one day he jumps out of the Michael Strahan suit. He's actually just been inside operating it like a Men in Black alien.
Very possible.
All this time.
Very
it's
possible.
Been me the whole time.
Yeah,
or whatever
but,
he would
that,
say.
But that's what he. But honestly, when I ran into him in the supermarket, I looked at him. Hey, Regis, he goes, how come they're stuck in the cat food like this? I'm like, Regis, you don't like have to be. It's Sunday, like you don't. But that's
who we get
is.
That take?
Yeah.
No, Regis, we're not on.
That's what he is. And Dave, you know, he isn't that kind of guy. You know, show business, I think it's two kind of guys, right? And Dave's the other kind of guy. So I think when he's around a lot of people, you know, socially awkward is not right the right word, but he's, you know, I just think he's not comfortable. You know, he's not a performer that way.
Well, having never met Dave.
No, we haven't met him either.
Not
we here.
Not knowing anything.
John touched his ass once.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was probably okay though.
It's just what I do.
It's
his
thing.
Gonna be your thing from now on.
Asses yeah. I've touched.
You're
that's
have
the coffee
to touch
table
the ass
book.
Of every late night host.
Yeah, Pat Sajak.
I see the wheels turning.
The wheels are turning.
You're going to have to hit Chevy Chase and Dennis Miller.
Oh,
same
man.
Time.
Well, this is a good question. Who would be the worst late night talk show hosts asked to touch?
Well, what would make it bad? I mean...
Oh, I think you know what's bad.
I don't know. It's all the same to me, honestly.
Maybe you should be president.
It's not. Did Regis ever have a late night talk show?
No.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. Maybe back in the 20s.
He just used to show up to an empty sound stage, but they didn't have the technology yet.
I think he.
Hey, pal, you sure you don't want to slide a finger in while you're down there? Number one.
Just
for the record, that was Chris, not me. Just in case.
This is Rob Burnett doing an impression of Regis Philbin, begging for someone to invade my anus with a finger.
Nope, the whole ass thing and the finger thing, I'm steering clear.
I am definitely Rob Burnett in this scenario.
Nope. Not me.
This is my personal platform.
Now I have an English accent for some reason.
This is Rob Burnett, representative of Worldwide, saying Regis
Suddenly,
Philbin likes
to be I'm now, I'm Rob. Robin Leach all of a sudden.
English Regis.
English Regis.
A nice little bit for your act, too, I think.
And that's not all. Let's go to the guest house in the back and dinner for 50.
Is Robin Leach still alive?
I don't know. Have you touched his ass ever?
He'd
be a good one, I think. What about Morton Downey Jr.?
Oh, yeah. You remember when I said it's all the same to me? I would not want to touch that.
You'd have
that.
To dig up the remains of Morton. That's like your quest. That's the last item on the bucket list.
You just jam your finger into a pile of ash.
God.
It smells like anger. Hey, I hope Dave appreciates, again, not knowing anything about him personally, but I always sense, you know, like you said, Johnny's this idol that he holds. Like, he's the guy. Johnny's the guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just assuming, piecing what I know from most comedy people, that we're never fully satisfied. And so I hope he does appreciate, though, that he is a hero to a whole, you know, to a huge generation of comedy types.
Yeah, I don't know that he allows himself that. It's you know, maybe in his private moment, I would hope that at some point, you know, he can take a breath and kind of realize what he's accomplished, but he gives no outward indication of being able to do that.
Is it dangerous to do that? Do you think we have to constantly be in that like, I'm never satisfied, because it just keeps us kind
probably,
of trying to get...
Probably so. I mean, I you know, but there's levels of that. I mean, I think Dave, of people I've met, he is... there is no one harder on himself and material than Dave. And frankly, it's I think a great thing for people like for me and John who grew up writing here. It's in your DNA. You know, you learn from writing here that the first three things you think of that anyone else would be satisfied will be rejected by Dave. So you push to the fourth thing and the fifth thing. And whatever happens to me in my career, I think is largely owed to that process.
Yeah.
You know, it's I think anyone that comes out of here will. I've seen the interviews. I think George Meyer said the same thing. Everyone that goes through this process, I think it's like boot camp. It's comedy boot camp.
Well, I don't know how you. I mean, the idea of being because you started interning here in like 85.
2 weeks ago.
Right. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's a fast rise.
It's a pretty sweet office for an intern.
Yeah. Everyone else touched celebrities' asses. I was the only one that didn't.
See, John. Your little bit didn't pay off.
I think it did.
I don't. I mean, just the idea of being a kid in a room. And not being so overcome by fear. Well, I guess in 85, Dave's still, you know, like
he was already starting to be a deal, and I was completely overwhelmed. When I started here as an intern right out of college. I was in the talent department, and then I started writing jokes, and then eventually I got a writing job. Funny story about my writing job. You have to make a little writing submission. At that time, the staff, there was very little movement. It was this group of guys, and there were no jobs. Finally, one opened up, a bunch applied, and it came down to three people from all these hundreds of submissions. It was a guy named Boyd Hale, who you have no reason to know. It was me, and it was Conan O'Brien.
Oh, shit.
The three of us. And Boyd Hale got the job. And what's great about this is that Conan is still, to this day, extremely upset about this. It's one of the greatest things I love about... I love so much about Conan, but this in particular I love. I ran into him at the Emmys, I don't know, 4 years ago, and we happened to chat about this. And if you mention the name Boyd Hale, you will see him flush, and he still can't believe he didn't get the job. And he said, and he'll tell you that he just thought this was a fork in the road of his life because he went to Harvard back then. A lot of the guys went to Harvard. He was a real profile of a Letterman writer,
yeah,
and hilarious, by the way. And they just wanted to try someone from the outside. This kid was like a copywriter from Oklahoma, and Conan really just thought. So in his mind, there's an alternate universe where he is a failure or something. Because I said to him, Conan, you're rich, you've got your own show, people love you, you know, you're hilarious, it's all fine. He's like, Boyd Hale, I can't believe Boyd Hale got that job.
You know how Boyd Hale is like sleeping in a barrel.
Yeah, exactly.
That job ruined me.
Because that's what poor people do, they sleep in barrels.
They do. It's not they sleep in barrels, it's just I think if you really understand how it works, they put suspenders on a barrel.
Right, exactly. That's their clothes.
Which becomes their clothes
and
their
sleeping.
I guess in the 30s, homeless people were like turtles.
Yeah.
And they just had these barrel shells.
I've never understood that image.
Yeah.
Like, were barrels more plentiful and easier to acquire
than fabric
than a sheet?
Yeah.
Or,
they also seem very heavy.
Yeah,
and it seems, I don't want to get grim, but it seems like it would rub against your penis, right?
Well,
like, it's wood, like, it doesn't feel comfortable.
Well, back in those days, everyone was heavily calloused just from living in the 20s and the 30s. The depression really...
But no more so than the people that wore barrels.
No, well, I think your penis had a tiny barrel around it.
Oh, maybe so. Yeah. That's how condoms were invented, actually. That's the... If you Google, Wikipedia will tell you. That's where it all came from.
I'm positive that if you have a barrel as a condom, you cannot get another barrel pregnant. That's what I think I know. But yeah, people were more robust back then.
Yes.
Now we're just...
We're soft.
Yeah, we're soft.
We're soft.
We're a culture of...
cotton.
Of hand sanitizer pussies that could never...
It's a cotton culture now.
That's right. That's like, you know, when you go, oh, it'd be really fun to go back in time, and I always think, you would never survive.
It would suck. No,
it would
suck.
You wouldn't be able to handle whatever the indigenous bacteria were.
Right. Right.
The drinking water was...
John and I have had this conversation many times that, you know, a king in the 1700s, His life was nothing compared to the average person that goes to the mall, to the food court mall, right? Like, if you think about it, it's a bounty of food, of sushi and chickens and all of this stuff.
Yep.
A king back
then. From all over the world.
Right, China, here's Chinese food and hot dogs and all this stuff. It's insane.
That people would have died to just bring back, like, a fucking jar of pepper.
Right, salt. That's you know, 600,000 guys died bringing the queen salt. It's like, really?
Where I come from, the spice is in tiny paper packets. What's paper? Exactly.
Like it's, we are spoiled now. We are absolutely spoiled. What do you think the next the next 10 generations are going to be spoiled over?
Yeah. Good question.
I don't know.
Maybe it'll go back. You don't know. It could be the big circle.
Back in the old days, they wore cotton on their bodies. Like savages.
But I remember the first time, getting back to that, I remember very distinctly the first writer's meeting I went to, and I did get the next job, and I was 24 or 25, sitting in this writer's room, and I have never felt terror like this in my life, because it was all these guys that had been doing this for a while. I'm sitting in this, and it's my dream. You know, here it is. I'm now in this room, and it was a top 10 list meeting. And Steve O'Donnell, who was just this crazy genius, you know, he was the head writer, and he was just really one of the funniest people I've ever met. He's running the thing, and all of a sudden, you know, it was pressure. It was right before the show. We used to write the top 10 list back then. And so he's, you know, he goes, think. And one of the other writers said, what? You want me to take a drink? And then another writer said, you only hear what you want to hear. And then another writer said, then why am I hearing you? And I literally wanted to say, thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to get up and open a deli. It's been fun. I'm going to leave this room now. I don't belong here. Goodbye.
I love that joke.
It was amazing.
That is like a comment thread on Reddit or something.
Yeah,
like, and you only hear what you want.
Yeah, but it literally happened in 4 seconds, and I just was like, "Oh!" My bowel released, and I'm like, "I'm in the wrong business. I've got to get out of here." And
the top 10 lists. I mean, like that defined people still when you're pitching, when you're doing a show, and there's any kind of talk about it, you're like, what's our top 10 list going to be? Don't do a top 10 list. It's already been done perfectly.
It's funny because Dave here is asking what our top 10 list is going to be, meaning we need a new one of those and we can't come up
with
it.
Like there's the, I love the formula that I hope this isn't taken the wrong way, but I just love that number one was not always the best answer.
Don't get me started, because this is perfect for the Nerdist. You want nerdism here.
But when you watch a top 10 list, there's a formula.
Oh, yes.
And you go, you know, first one funny, next three great, like fifth one amazing.
Here's the formula.
Okay.
Now every head writer, and I was head writer, John at a separate time was head writer, so everyone has their own little, you know, thing, but
I just used your formula.
Okay, here's my top 10 formula, all right? It goes like this. Now, keep in mind, just for all the snarky people listening to this, you want 10 amazing jokes, then it would be easy, but you don't always... You know what I mean? You don't have all the time.
I think it works better that they're not 10 amazing jokes. It gives it a flow.
Exactly. You don't want 10 amazing jokes. You want a flow. That's what we're going for. So here's what it always was. Number 10 for me had to be very straightforward and reinforce the premise.
Yep.
You didn't want anything nutty. You know what I mean?
Right. It's
top 10.
Number 10's the one you might see that in the trailer for the top 10 list, where it's just showing you
exactly
here's what this concept
is. It's structurally expositional.
Right. It's funny, and you want to get a laugh, because you know you want to get a laugh, but it's right down the middle.
Your hand into the press.
Yes. Get what we're doing, people. That's what number 10 says. Number 9. Similar, you know, but you might start taking a little bit of a chance, but you still, you know, you want to get the list, you know, generally in comedy you want to build, right?
You have to guide the audience.
However, you also want, in the top 10, you've got to turn the laugh on.
Right.
So it's two different things, right?
Okay.
You don't want to go from these suck, funny, 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 because by then they're gone.
Right.
So I always wanted to make the first two, you know, not the best, but like we got to get some laughs.
Yeah.
Now when you get to number 8, okay, now you've earned your right to take the chance, right? Now you're going to put the one on that you love, that you're pretty sure the audience may not, you know.
Whoa. In my mind, seriously, This is number 7.
Well, it is number 7.
Why do you got to touch his bits butt?
No.
Well, like I told you, it's what I do.
You are kind of right. Seven. I went a little too far. No, you're absolutely right. In the formula, 7 is the one that you're really going out there with. That's true.
Okay.
But 8, I stand corrected.
You're taking chances.
You
on
are correct. 8, you're starting to take a little bit of a chance.
Okay.
Right? 7 is, that's correct. 7 is the one where it's like, all right, people, you know, this is for the nerds. This is for the comedy nerds. It's a great joke. We're getting points in heaven. Hopefully you're going to laugh. If you don't, it's your problem, not ours.
Right.
That's number 7. Because number 6, you've got backup coming around the corner.
Yep.
Because, and this makes no real sense. John, actually, I remember, this is one of my favorite things. You probably don't even remember this, but one of my favorite things is John at some point, he's just got this very beautiful, I mean, his, you know, he's got a great way of thinking of things, which is why I love working for him.
He almost said a beautiful mind,
he sort of does have a beautiful mind, a beautiful comedic mind. But he also has a very understated, low-key, soothing baritone of way of saying this. And I just remember there was one day, well, first I'll explain the principle. So number 6 is the crowd-pleasing one that's going to get applause.
Yeah. Or maybe the woo, which you don't seek in comedy, but you'll take it from a number 6 because you just want to make sure there's noise.
It's a tent pole in the middle of your list, right? So you've got this thing that right here, you've got a, you know, it's the one where Dan Quayle's an idiot, you know? It's like, what?
Number 6 is the pandery crowd.
Exactly.
Right.
If you're going to pander,
it's literally
pander, it's
always, you just say Dan Quayle's an idiot. Just that actual one. Yeah, Buttafuoco was one for a while.
every day.
Judge Ito.
In fact, one.
Judge Ito.
You know what one of my.
I think that one's still on Leno's list.
Right.
You know what one of my favorite things ever with the top 10 list was? This was amazing. So we had done Buttafuoco at one point was just, it was a switch. He said Buttafuoco and the place went nuts. There was one time where we were done with Buttafuoco for like a year. He was out of the news. We had some list. It was a completely random list. I was in Dave's office and I just said to him, what if just, I mean, literally it was like top 10, I don't know, signs the president is dumb or something. No, it wasn't even that. It was, I can't remember the topic, but it had nothing, even syntactically, even grammatically, where Buttafuoco could answer the topic.
Like signs you have a bad dentist or something.
Right, exactly. But not even that, because that almost would suggest that Buttafuoco is your dentist. Like it literally had nothing to do with it. And I just said, what if we just put on Buttafuoco and just see what happens? We just put on Buttafuoco in the middle of the list a year later, and we did. And it was like, number 3, Buttafuoco. The place goes insane. They went nuts. They were screaming with joy. They loved it. But anyway, getting back to John. So number 6 is the big crowd pleaser.
Yep.
And the top 10, you know, we have two panels of graphics, right?
Yep.
The first on one and then on the other.
Then you got to wipe the graphics
right
over.
And for years, I would always say, like, well, number 6, and this may have come from, some of this may have come from Steve O'Donnell, who I inherited the job from, some of this may have, all credit to him, maybe, I don't know even anymore, but it was always, well, number 6, you know, that helps us get to the second panel, you know what I mean,
right?
That, because you get the new panel, and for years, I'd been saying this, and one day, one random day, John's like, he just says, it doesn't take any extra time to get to the second panel. Which is completely right. There's just no pause. You don't. There is. It's completely.
The old guys have to come out and reload the panel.
There's nothing. Right. It's absolutely unnecessary.
Wiped off the chalkboard from the old.
There's
the first.
Nothing. And it literally just. But so focused on this for several years until one smart guy just says, you know, that makes no sense at all. And he was completely right. But nonetheless, 6 is. It's still in your 10 pole position. 5, I think you start to take another little chance with, but here you're now starting to build your better jokes, right? And then
maybe I mean, if we're going to get super anal about this, I would say maybe I was wrong to do it this way, but when I was putting them together, I think 5 would actually be one of your weakest jokes.
Because you had 6, you just got the big laugh for 6, so you could tail
right
off of that.
Like, you
kind of
just got to keep it moving at that point, right?
I think 5 and 8 would be where I would stash my least favorite jokes.
That's exactly right. That's exactly, me too. Same place. And then, but really, and some of this you work in reverse. Usually the good ones, number 2 is always the best.
Right.
Because number 1 kind of gets, number 1 has to be short.
That's important to Dave.
So you can ramp it up and go, and number one, toast for breakfast, everybody.
Boom, and the band is it. Dave always wants number one to be the funniest, so he sometimes will get on you for that. But
he also wants it to be short. Short and pithy.
So based on that, number one is just kind of like, it's a cherry on a sundae. It's not the funniest thing necessarily, but it's like, there's your ender, but it's short. Two is always the funniest. And three was always, I thought, the second funniest. Because you really want to kind of get that ramping up. Right. And I would say four, probably the third funniest. Right?
Or maybe 10. Maybe,
yeah, well, 10 could.
Maybe 10.
10 might, yep, I agree. We're
maybe 7, that. You know.
Well, 7 could be funny in the, if they get it.
7's the Charlie Kaufman.
Yes.
You know.
Yep.
2 is the, Seth MacFarlane.
It's Hangover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always like, 2 is that last lilt. Like right before number one just glides you into Paul.
You
and
got
the band.
It. You are now qualified to be head writer.
Oh my God, that's great!
Speaking of this, you now have more. When I became head writer of the show, Steve O'Donnell left. I was 29 years old, and so as terrified as I was when I got into that room to be a writer, I'm 29 years old, and they call me in and they say, "Oh, you know, Steve O'Donnell is leaving. You're going to be the head writer." And I'm like, okay. I was like, all right. And now I was too dumb to be scared, actually, because I'd been in the room and I had had some success at this point. I was, you know, feeling pretty good about stuff. And I'm like, all right, great. And I had a good relationship with Dave because I was sort of in charge of the remote pieces that we had done for about a year. So I, you know, worked with him very closely. So I'm like, okay, great. And I went. I remember I went away by chance for the weekend with my buddies. I came back on Monday and I realized I had no idea what the head writer did. None. Like there was, you know, because the way the show works is, it's the writers and then the head writer really was the you know, it's the complete interface with Dave.
Yeah.
It's changed a bit now, but that's kind of how it was. There was the one little pocket of the remote guy, so I had that one interface, but I really didn't know literally anything. Like, how does the top 10 list get into the machine? Like, I didn't know how to do any of it. And I've never, and it was actually awful. And for the, when I was first, and Dave's way a little bit is, he will kind of put you through the test. At least he did with me. When I, because Steve O'Donnell, you know, couldn't have been better as a head writer. I mean, he had done it for 6 years. He was, you know, he was the king of this. Created along with Merrill Marcoux a lot of the great things on this show. I credit to Steve and Merrill.
Are you still at NBC at this point?
Still at NBC.
Last year at NBC.
So last year at NBC. This was right when John.
Yeah.
John got hired right before I was head writer. And the beginning was really rough. And I remember Dave just torturing me, but really for good reason. You know, I was tentative, which does not play well against him, you know, with him. I didn't know what I was doing. I remember just really floundering, and then there was a turning point for me. There was one day we were down in rehearsal, and we didn't know what we were doing. Like Dave threw out the act one is our comedy piece, threw out the act one. We had nothing. Rehearsal's running out. Everybody's looking at me. I kind of had this other thing that was sort of half-baked. I had a couple other things. And I he just got up and left.
Oh.
Rehearsal. Because sort of it was kind of over, but there was nothing going up. There was nothing to rehearse. So he kind of got up and left. And it was like 10 to 4. Rehearsal ends at 4. I'm literally, you know, seeing my life and career flash before my eyes. So I went up to his office and I said, well, because there were two options, and everyone was asking me, well, which of these are we gonna do? And I went into his office and I said, what are we gonna do? And he turned to me in a very stern voice and said, this is supposed to work the other way around. And he turned and walked away.
Oh, shit.
And that moment for me, that was the moment where I just said, he's right. It is supposed to work the other way around. Because you got to keep in mind, I was also running a writer's room with guys that were, you know, 10 years... Like, all these guys that, you know, were intimidating to me as a writer were in this room. You know, not all of them. A lot of them had gone at that point to go to The Simpsons, but they're still, you know.
Were they crusty that you got the head writing job?
No. Actually, there was not resentment that I got the head writing job. It wasn't that kind of situation. I had everybody's support, but I still was intimidated by a lot of these guys. And it's sort of like being the quarterback of a football team where, you know, you get called in, you're the backup quarterback, and you're in the huddle, and you're like, all right, guys, so what kind of play do you think we should run?
Right.
You can't do it that way. And you got to get to the, you know, and literally the next day, I just said to myself, I'm either going to succeed or I'm going to fail, but I'm not going to go out this way.
Well, there is that kind of switch that clicks when you're nervous and tentative and you don't know if you should be there, and then one day you just kind of go, what the fuck am I freaking out about? And then you kind of just grab it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, everything kind of falls into place.
I think for me, my dreams overwhelm my fear. You know what I mean? At some point, I'm just like, this is, and it happened too when I was a regular writer in that room. I'm just like, this is all I've ever dreamt of in my life, is to be a comedy writer, and then in my later life for this particular show, and I now have an opportunity. I can't let anybody stand in my way. I just can't be intimidated.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to be. I might fail because I suck, and we'll find that out. But I've got to do this. And from that point on, you know, I took control of the thing, and you know, Dave and I then had a great relationship. I mean, not necessarily within 24 hours, but eventually it all kind of clicked. And then I was head writer, really at a very fertile time where we went from NBC to CBS.
What a weird transition too, because I mean, you know, I don't know if. I mean, I guess people who listen to this podcast would have an understanding of it, but there is definitely a tonal shift from late night to just late night.
Yeah.
It's more primetime,
yep,
kind of an audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how do you take a guy like Dave, who is really the sort of rule breaker, you know, and make him palatable for a bigger, broader audience?
Yeah, but you know what? Dave is also very smart about that stuff in his own way. Like, he... First of all, Dave, you know, he was getting older. You know, he was aging as well. You know what I mean? He wasn't old, but, you know, the idea of, like, jumping up and going onto Velcro walls had already started to become unappealing to him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he has a very good barometer of kind of evolving himself, mm-hmm, in a way. And I think a lot of what happened for us... First of all, I think Dave himself was very conscious of Johnny Carson and what Johnny Carson was. And I think he himself knew... There are certain things at 12:30 that won't play at 11:30. I'm now in front of a broader audience. I need to do things a different way. And I don't think anyone cajoled him. You can't, you know, he knows what he wants to do and he does it. I think a huge factor in the evolution of the show, and John, I think you can probably back me up on this, was the theater.
Yeah.
The studio at NBC, I think it's at 166A.
It's very intimate feeling.
Oh, I've seen those little studios, but I saw Conan's old studio, and it's
yeah,
like,
same studio.
It's okay.
6A.
It's really small.
It's tiny.
It's like I think 160 is the number I had in my head. Maybe I'm wrong. And our theater here is 461, and it's an enormous space.
Yeah.
And it also opens up onto the street.
Yeah.
And, which was a huge part of the show when we first came here. You know, that's when we started to realize, wow, you can just open the door, you know, and put a camera out.
But this,
there.
The Ed Sullivan feels like a theater too, and the old NBC and the NBC studios, the people are crammed in.
They're
sitting
elevated.
In bleachers, looking,
yes,
down at the show.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the Sullivan Theater, people are sitting down, looking up at a stage.
Right.
And it's a different. It's
point.
A different comedy dynamic.
It's really different, and you found that there were, the show needed to get a little bigger as a result of.
Yeah,
this.
I mean, even just from a dynamic standpoint, it's. He's in a much more socially reverent position,
yeah,
being up above everyone as opposed to,
yeah,
hey, that people pointing down going, hey, look at that. He's jumping up on that Velcro wall.
Yeah.
I think there's truth in that. I mean, I was only at the old show for a year, so I'm not the authority on it. But when we started at CBS, some of the best shows we did, I think, were shows that you couldn't have done at NBC. And I love this stuff on NBC. I'm not even saying one's better than the other, but like the show at CBS started to feel on good nights almost like a comedy circus,
yeah,
where it was like a crazy level of activity and production that was just so much fun, you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
You could just do these big, silly, ridiculous shows, you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I think that would have been harder in that little boxy, you know,
studio.
Yeah, we filled up the stage. I mean, that's what we did. We filled up the stage here, and
some people liked that less, by the way. You know, I think most people liked it more, but I think there were some people who, you know, probably went on to become big Conan fans, you know, as well, who, like, you know, I mean, from a comedic standpoint, I think I was drawn to the awkwardness and, like, I mean, I've told Rob many times, like, when I got hired as a writer as a kid, the big lesson I had to learn was that Dave actually wanted the jokes to get laughs. Because I had been sitting watching the old show in my, you know, college dorm room or whatever, and what I loved was when he would do a weird joke, it would die. Like, there'd be silence. And then he would, you know, have to wriggle his way out of it or get mad. Yeah, I loved when he got mad. And I thought, that's what the show is. The show is about a guy who kind of is cranky and gets mad at how crappy
it kind of is now. We're back.
But I love that. And I sort of thought, okay, what my job is to come up, like, I remember some of the things I wrote, you know, when I was first starting that were extremely non sequitur based mm-hmm. comedy, which
did,
I actually
did. You think, find an old packet of your stuff you were telling me that had my notes on it of when the stuff you turned in?
Yeah, and you had written things like, you know, like, I keep in mind the point of this is to actually make an audience.
that sounds like I'm a dick.
And no, but I looked at this stuff and I was writing for what I thought was, you know, shooting at a particular target. It was just the wrong one. Right. I was trying to write the stuff that was so weird that people would stare at Dave like they didn't know what he was talking about. And because that's what I enjoyed watching the show.
That's kind of a young comedy writer thing, though, is to, like, I'm going to go fucking weird,
right.
And I'm going to make the audience be like, what?
Yeah, you get that all the time here. With it happens traditionally here when young kids come in, and but you can see that, you know, and certainly with the case with John, who honestly ended up, you know, possibly being the best writer ever here. I would put him up there. You know, you see this, you know, you can see the liveliness in there, and then you just have to try to shape it and, you know, get it into form, and then people start to figure out, here's how we can do this. And we can keep the brightness of it and still get the laugh. It's kind of, you know, when I was head writer, I always used to have this, the comedy quadrants, which John is completely...
I haven't heard this term in a while,
yeah,
but this is good.
I'm sure he's sick of hearing it, but it's what I just fully believe when you're doing a show like this, and maybe with all comedy, is, you know, it's, you've got the four quadrants, and you've got on one side, you've got the stuff that will get laughs, mm-hmm. and on the other side, you have the stuff that doesn't get laughs, right? That's your horizontal, your vertical axis.
Yep.
I mean, you really can orient your chart. You guys can orient your charts any way you like at home.
I really want that to be horizontal.
You know what? I'm going to do it horizontal for you.
Okay.
And then the other...
Oh, no, wait, I like vertical, because I like watching you put your arm up.
Just make your mind up. Well, because you have another axis.
Can we do diagonals like pizza?
No, that's too complicated.
Okay.
So you've got one half of the side where people are going to laugh, the other side not going to laugh, and then you have... Above, you have stuff that is really good, you know, the stuff that comedy writer, like, that you're going to get points for in heaven.
Sure.
That's just good. It's original, and it's fresh, and it's good. And then you've got the stuff on the bottom that is not good. It's pandering and bad, right? So when you look at those four quadrants, what you have is you've got that stuff that, you know, like the Dan Quayle stupid, and it works on the television show because everyone laughs. But it's on this side of the line, right?
So it's good because it does well, but it's bad because
it's not funny,
it's bad comedy,
right? So you're right. So it's not really good, and the people at home, you know, probably shouldn't really be liking that. It's just, but it's keeping the show moving, right? And then you have the best stuff, which is, you know, like I put, for example, like those pieces we used to do, like Dave with Rupert, where, you know, Dave would, you know, tell Rupert what to say, and then Rupert would repeat it.
Yeah.
John's idea, by the way, and interestingly, almost was John. Originally, it was like my friend Phil or something it was called.
It was called Fun with Phil.
Fun with Phil. And John was going to be the guy that Dave, just as a stooge, would repeat everything. And then at the last minute, Dave's like, I think we should have somebody that's kind of attached to the show that we know, so we turn it into Rupert. But that stuff would kill. It was hilarious. And it was very sophisticated and rarefied. Like, the stuff Dave was saying was... weird and beautiful and just, you know, as high level comedy as you can get. Like, that's the quadrant you want to be in. And then down here, you have stuff that comedy lovers love that gets no laughs at all. But you know what? I would put some of that on the show every once in a while. And the example that I always use, and I think a writer named Donna Carey wrote this. It was a viewer mail letter. They had come in. It was like something like, Dave, what do you do on the weekends or whatever? And the joke was just like, oh, or what did you do last weekend? I had a meeting with my silent fake beard club. And it was a flashback. And Dave's like, oh. And then you literally see this long table, and there's a big banner, and it's Silent Fake Beard Club. And it's a bunch of guys sitting there with beards, and no one's saying anything for a long time. And then someone, like, I think, bangs a gavel or a clock goes off, and they all get up and, like, okay, good job. See you next week. Right?
That was one of my favorite viewer mails ever.
And literally, when I tell you that played to dead silence, you have no idea. The silence. And I knew an audience is just not going to understand that. But you know what? You got to have some of that.
Well, but right there, that's the quadrant of the Mystery Science Theater quadrant of, like, but the right people will get this.
Sure. Right.
And I love this idea of the comedy quadrant because, you know, and then I think the top 10 list is sort of a microcosm of that because it requires a perfect balance of all of it in order to kind of mix it up with the audience and pull in a lot of different people.
Well, that's what I think the writers don't always understand, and myself included when I was a writer, you start to learn when you're head writer is that there's a whole show that has to go on here. It's not just about your little thing, right? So there's guests that come out, right? Dave's got to be out there in front of an audience and do stuff. So if you have, you know, another rule that we didn't talk about at the top 10 very simply for all the analysis, I never wanted to have two jokes that didn't get a laugh in a row. Mm-hmm. Because I knew if two didn't get a row, Dave would then start blowing through the rest of the list because he'd lose confidence in it. And to some extent, that exists on the show as a whole. You know, you know, it's okay, silent fake beard, that does something to the show in that theater. It brings the energy down. Right. Dave's got to climb his way out of that. You know what I mean? You can't just keep doing that to him, like one thing after another.
But
you know what I mean?
That's what kind of makes following it up with Buttafuoco even more genius is that you are purposely manipulating the audience in a way that allows you to do the kind of jokes you want to do and then do jokes to balance it up. Dave?
That's Dave. The podcast is going on too. Stop talking about me.
I can hear you in there.
Actually, it's Dave calling about it. He's just found out that John touched Johnny Carson's butt.
Johnny came to my dream last night, you know, in that snowy mountainside he lives in. Oh my God, you too? That's just how Johnny appears. Did you just hang up on Dave?
Yeah. Yes.
I told you not to bother me. It's like that old Rickles.
You know that story, right?
With Frank?
Yeah.
That he was the only person that when Frank would call, he'd be able to go, I told you not to, and then hang up on him.
No. Well, it's a version of that. The show business story that I've always heard is that when Rickles was starting out as a kid, he was opening for Frank, and he said to Frank, you know, I'm having dinner with this showgirl tonight. If you could just come over and just say
hello. Right.
And then he comes over, and Rickles says, I told you not to bother me during dinner, Frank. It was great.
So, I mean, Dave, it seems like he's in it.
I think so. You know, I mean, Dave is, he can still get around on the fastball. That's what it kind of comes down to. You know, I think I once heard Dave say, I think Emmett Smith, but I could be wrong, during an interview, Emmett Smith was talking about how the thing that made him retire from football was that he couldn't take the practices. Mm-hmm. He was fine for the game, but he couldn't do everything he needed to prepare himself for the practice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Dave, I think, has come to the point where, because this is not professional football, he has very smartly kind of reduced the energy and effort, you know what I mean, that is needed to get him to a point where he can still get on air.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When he's on air, he's still amazing. You know what I mean? But the shape of the show, production wise, has changed. I mean, when John and I were head writers, you were in his office all day long. You were pitching jokes. You were doing all this stuff. You know, he's kind of delegated that stuff a little bit. I'm sorry. That's my office. This must be something super important. Hold on.
Robin, stay. Were you talking about my process again?
Hey, do you want to touch his butt? He's just...
Sorry about that.
What's that?
That's all right. Yeah. But what's interesting about Dave is that, you know, you see him on the air and he's as quick as he's ever been, you know what I mean? And what I think what's interesting about a show like this is as Dave gets older and now he's got a kid and of course there's always new topical events, there's always inputs that are coming in. So now you've got, you know, a 60 plus year old guy making fun of stuff with that perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's Dave again has I think been very smart at evolving himself. You know, you don't want to be Gallagher smashing watermelons at 65 and you're still smashing the watermelons.
You want to move to cantaloupes or grapes?
I think so. And Dave has moved to grapes. I think we've got our ending.
That's it. But Dave is a guy that makes me not be afraid to get older. I'm just looking at him and go, hey, you know what? He's in his 60s and
he's still cool.
He's still cool and he's still funny and
he's still relevant.
He's still working every day. Like, it's not... Yeah. You know, like, maybe it can be okay. Like, he actually, so now that I'm kind of getting to that age where I go, oh, yeah, you know, there's an end point to everything.
Yeah.
It's nice to go, all right, but it doesn't have to be then.
Yeah.
Like, he's, you know.
No, Dave is still funny in a cool way. Like, it's a kind of amazing to me that, you know, because we do know what happens to older people in comedy. You know, it's that mystery where a lot of them just lose their way. Like, they cling to kind of old stuff or whatever it is, and they're just making jokes that are really old-fashioned, and you just kind of feel like, just, you know, you used to be a genius, and now you're not. And Dave is just not doing
that. I think that has... Because I think about that a lot, obviously. And I think a lot of that has to do with desperation and hunger. Like, you know, when comics get to a certain level of success, usually... they get very comfortable and they get kind of cushy and they just don't have that hunger to go out and try to, you know, there's that desperation in comedy where it's like, no matter how cool you are on stage, you still want people to like you.
Right.
Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be doing, it wouldn't matter to you to try to make people laugh because you wouldn't give a shit.
Right.
So, you know, when people get comfortable, they're not as hungry. They don't workshop as much. They're not looking at what else is going out there. I mean, like, you know, Joan Rivers came on the podcast, and she's still super hungry, and she's still super fucking funny.
Right. She's amazing.
And so, you know, she's 79 years old.
But I think some of it goes deeper than that, honestly. I do think that's a huge part of it. But I think some of it, too, is the thing that I fear the most is your ability to kind of update your sensibility. You know what I mean? It's
right.
Like, it's kind of interesting for me, because I think that there's a lot of stuff that we did on this show that, you know, I was a part of, as John was a part of, many people, that I think is now commonplace. You know, I think Dave, there's a sensibility, a Letterman sensibility, that has now kind of gone out into the world.
Oh my, there's
it's like
no
the baseline
question.
Sensibility.
There's no question. It's a very... It's a very aware, self-referential,
right. Ironic, dry,
fucking with the system,
right?
Like, yeah.
But what's interesting now is, you know, and it's funny. I had this conversation with my kids, where, you know, they're watching, you know, whatever they're watching, and I have to try to explain to them that, like, you don't understand how unusual it was for Dave to, like, you know, show a stagehand, you know, back then to do a comedy bit, or have this guy Larry Bud Melman, who was just so strange, like. Show business was very polished back then, and of course there's weird pockets of examples, I think, like Ernie Kovacs or something before Dave, so, you know, that always happens the way things evolve. But Dave really popularized a certain sensibility, and it's funny, John and I actually ran into this problem ourselves when we were making this movie. The kids, so when they go out to do their bad Jackass movie, we thought what we would do is we'd have them go out and do remotes, sort of the way we do Letterman style, and we'd actually interact with real people on the street. And
like Borat, but, you know,
but
the
bad.
Idea being that they're bad at it, not a genius
right.
like Sasha.
But it was kind of interesting because we sort of got out there, and what we kind of both, there were a lot of reasons where that aspect of things had to be changed. It's different now in the movie. But I think both of us, when we were sitting down trying to do these remotes, had the experience of realizing by definition, you know, we did all of these remotes like in 1994, 95. Like, we did all of this stuff. And it's now not new anymore because we did it. And right. Now everyone else has done it. I don't mean to, I'm not trying to overblow our state, you know.
I feel like in this instance, it's okay to do that.
But do you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like there's even a certain kind of like cut. I mean, to get very nerdy about it, but where else but here? I mean, there's a certain kind of like cutaway that we used to use on the Letterman show of like, you know, all of a sudden that weird, awkward cut of like just some weird guy staring at something that
yeah.
you just see now in commercials, and it's just the way things are done. So it's like for like if I were to go out now with Dave and like start doing those remotes and doing them, and then like, oh, here we go, I would think this is funny, and it would be funny, but it wouldn't be fresh.
That's what's so funny, that in a weird sort of way, you guys started this thing that if you did it now, people would be like, oh, that's hacky. And you go, no, but we...
That,
right.
This is exactly the point I'm making. I think this happens to, like, genius comedians. Like, you know, people... I'm not saying this happened to them, but for example, it could happen to someone like Bill Cosby, for example. You know what I mean? Like, where he was this, you know, groundbreaking kind of genius comedian who now is doing stuff... You know what I mean? Like,
or look at Woody Allen, where sometimes now, if in one of his movies he does a Woody Allen line, sometimes people look at that and are like, ugh. You know, like, what is he?
It seems jokey. It's just kind of like...
But it's exactly what he was doing 30 years ago, and was genius.
It's the way his mind works, and it's what he finds funny.
Well, I guess just, you know, with comedy, you just have to surprise people. And when they feel like they're not being surprised...
Right.
And they feel like, you know, you already did that. I mean, it's just like, it's basically just like watching a magician do the same trick 20 times. Right. And then after a while, you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
I know. Oh, yeah, I could kind of see where you hid the... Yeah. All right. You know, it's just people need that to be engaged.
Right. And I think that is the real challenge, is to kind of continually to push yourself to update your sensibility. And I think that taps into what you're saying in terms of hunger. You know, if you're not... really driven to do that, because we look, all three of us were attracted to comedy in some way. We saw whoever it was, you know, for me, I don't know, Albert Brooks, of course, Woody Allen, you know, the usual suspects, you know, Steve Martin, Bill Murray, and you just loved it so much, and you probably in the beginning, you know, almost were imitating them, and then suddenly you were trying to find your own voice within them, and then breaking out to your own voice.
Yeah.
And that's hard work, really hard work. And you know, when you're right, when you start to get successful, you're kind of like,
You know what this makes me think of? I mean, you know, I think you have to allow yourself to continue to be pushed by what's happening in the present day.
Yeah.
Like, even by people who are younger than you.
Right.
Like, you have to allow them to be the fire under you, mm-hmm. you know? And, like, actually, I think this movie is sort of an example of that, because... Like, Rob and I have never written anything before this that had swearing in it. Like,
right.
You know, basically, you know what I mean? Everything we've done, or at least that's been, you know, produced and made its way out into the world, you know, was, you know, the Letterman Show, primetime series, you know, it's, you know, you're always pushing the envelope of what you can say, and you can be very funny by almost saying certain things.
Yeah.
But we never actually said them. And, like, so here we are making what's meant to be a movie made by real, you know, young people, real high school kids. And, like, you know, there was a lot of conversation about, well, what is the rating of this movie going to be? Like, how should we be writing this movie? And... They talk like we talk, you know.
Right.
They curse, and they make, you know, dirty jokes sometimes, and it, you know, and like, obviously that's what everyone does now in popular, you know, especially youth oriented movies. But like, it's kind of amazing to me to think that I had never produced anything with an R-rated sensibility.
That's the vernacular now. I'm so surprised now when I see online people are like, you know, if you say shit and they're like, hey, swearing. You're like, really? In 2012? Get the internet now. What's the problem?
But it's funny because but this issue we dealt with directly in the movie itself, because beyond the cursing, you know, a lot of what's funny, like a funny part of this movie is, you know, they're sitting there. There's a scene early in the movie that, you know, is really there kind of for comedy writers in a way. But LeBron, the main character, they've tried this stupid thing, chicken with a boner is their idea. So it's literally him, he's walking around with a chicken suit and a tennis ball can, and it's just, it's horrible, and it doesn't go well. But then there's this thing where he, and this is really for all the people that have ever worked for talk shows.
That's what a guy trying to be hilarious would do.
Exactly. Chicken with a boner. Right, chicken with a boner. Like, this is the greatest thing ever.
The two things are hilarious, yeah. Individually.
Right. It's amazing. Yeah. So that fails horribly. And then in the next scene, they're all sitting around and everyone's depressed. And you just see LeBron is sitting there and he's got the big board. And he's got the cards, you know, which anyone that's ever worked for any one of these
cards,
the index cards with the ideas, mm-hmm. you know, all taped up. And so he's been up all night just brainstorming by himself because he's a little more enthusiastic about all of this than his buddies are. The buddies are kind of doing it, but this is really his thing. So he's got the big board. And he's got all of these ideas. And John and I had so much fun writing up, because we didn't have to actually do these ideas, but you just see, it's a good freeze frame moment to just freeze and just see what some of these cards, like his ideas, the names of the sketches, you know what I mean? It's like, I think one is like, you know, vaginas on everything. You know, it was just ridiculous. And the one they look and one of them is called Shitako,
yeah.
and that's the one they what's Shitako? And it's LeBron basically telling them it's you know, we get a giant taco and we fill it with shit and we eat it, and they're all just looking at him like, and he's trying to explain like, that's what you got to do in a movie today, like, that's because then everyone's gonna say like, did you see that movie where they ate the shit, you know, and like they just have no, do you know what I mean, like it's this thing where they can't.
What you're describing is a perfect distillation of the internet.
Right, exactly. Like
constantly having to right. Turn it up. So we made this movie is by the time. Well, this is a little up tomorrow, so that means the movie is open today.
Yeah,
right?
the big premiere is tonight. So unfortunately, tonight. You could watch
you
it.
Could have
you could have
it
watched
free.
It for free. We're streaming it online for free.
Damn,
but Hartwick didn't care enough about you.
No,
nope.
I didn't.
Let him pay. You said I don't care. I don't care about the 40. Nothing I can do with those 47%. You're like Romney. 47% of my viewers, I don't listeners.
47% just want you to give them a movie for free. They're never gonna pay for a movie.
I'm realizing that all of your impressions are the same.
What?
Voice.
Hang on.
Is that
now
Robin?
I'm Obama. Hello.
They're all sort of that Robin Williams
yeah.
voice.
Now I'm Sarkozy. Oh.
Oh, yes.
Oh. Chicken with a boner. Oh, the trans and everything. Oh, shit taco. Oh. Oh, somebody shave me. Please. I can't see through my own face anymore. Oh.
That last one was good. You really got him there. Yeah, so the movie now is available on iTunes and all that stuff. But, you know, one last great thing about this movie that I have to mention is that we crowdsourced the music for this
Oh,
movie.
Shit, that's awesome.
Yeah, this is really cool.
Amazing thing. We hooked up with Red Bull Soundstage.
Yep.
And we put four scenes of the movie up on Red Bull, and we said, send us your music. And we thought we'd get like 30 or 40 submissions. We got 1,200 songs from brand new bands.
Oh, cool.
John and I listened to every last one of them. They were great. We ended up putting 22 songs in the movie, brand new songs, brand new bands you've never heard before. The soundtrack is awesome. One of the bands got a shot on Letterman of Gentlemen and Cowards, played last Monday. These four Canadian kids were just from college, couldn't believe it. You know, they got on here. So it's been a great, the whole release structure, Snag Films is our partner on the release. This online premiere was, you know, went amazingly well last night. The people loved it. So it's a whole new way to release a movie. It's, you know, hopefully it'll all work. And by the time people are listening to this, John and I will be gazillionaires.
Buck, 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 get on to my cock. I'm a chicken with a boner.
Where were you 3 months ago?
I didn't know about it.
Oh, God.
I would have written chicken with a boner for you.
Damn it. I wish you were here.
So really, just kind of in closing.
Yes, if we make $1 billion, we will get Pullman to be president.
President
yes.
Pullman! There'll be a place in the cabinet for you, President Pullman. Just for both of you, favorite, if you can remember, just favorite moment in the last several years of working on the Letterman show. What's a moment where you just stood off the side and went, holy shit, I can't, you know, this is amazing and I can't believe that I get to contribute to this?
Well, for me, I think the moment that I think I remember would be, we did a piece called Dave and Steve's Gay Vacation. Mm-hmm. It was Steve Martin's idea.
I remember this.
Yeah, it was very funny. Steve Martin's idea where, you know, basically they went on a gay vacation together.
A gaycation.
Nice. And John and I wrote a lot of it. Steve wrote a lot of it too. And I directed the little piece. And it was one of those things where there was a moment in time, and I think I have this footage somewhere in a box, and I hope to God it's not gone. There's some B-roll. I'm standing, and Steve and Dave are sitting in two chairs, and I'm directing them, and I'm explaining what we're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's just this thing where, and I was very focused because, you know, you're on a schedule and all that stuff, you know, you're doing, and I'm like, okay, no, it's got to be like this. And at that moment, I've lost, you know, I'm so focused that I'm not aware enough to realize who I'm talking to, really. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I'm completely, it's that thing that we all want to have where you're just in the moment. But all of a sudden, as I'm doing this, and it's just this footage of the two of those guys looking up at me and nodding, and I'm explaining, and literally there was all of a sudden, it hit me that I'm standing and I am now telling Steve Martin and David Letterman what to do, and they are listening eagerly to what I have to say. And that was the moment that I just, you know what I mean? You have that flashback moment where I'm just like, oh my God, you know, how can anything ever be better for me in my life?
Then you got to be careful, because in those moments, it's like just when you're learning to juggle or whatever, and then you finally get it going, you're like, oh, I'm juggling, and then you drop everything.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that probably happened, but it doesn't matter because I was juggling. I'll take it.
By the way, I could have gone with vacation, but honestly, in my head, I was like, but if you saw it written out, it would just look like vagation.
Which is a whole different
and
piece.
That wouldn't make sense.
Well, depends on the guest.
Just to give you some insight into my process. What about yours?
Well, this isn't super recent anymore, unfortunately, but, you know, I would say that one of the best experiences I had working on the show was just riding around in the van when Dave would do these pieces with Rupert that Rob was mentioning before. These fun with Rupert is what we called it. You know, I remember at the time that, you know, this was a piece that people really liked, and that like cool comedy writers that I looked up to, I remember hearing that they wanted to just get the unedited, you know, raw footage of Dave doing these things, which I still think would be, for any true comedy nerd, would just be like,
you know,
holy grail. I mean, we had to cut these things into pieces.
Pods.
But if you, yeah, we call them pods. But if you really wanted to enjoy.
That's when pods got invented.
That's true. You know, it was amazing to watch in real time as, you know, we would pull up to some street corner and Dave would say, you know, to Rupert, you know, go up to that guy eating a hot dog. And Dave would just start creating a world, like in real time, like the best, you know, improv comics can do, out of nothing. You know, where, you know, it would always be something like, you know, like I just got in from, you
Brazil.
Know, from Brazil, or like, you know, or like, you know, Fort Lauderdale or whatever. You know, he had always just arrived from somewhere, and he just starts making conversation with somebody who does not want to be spoken to by a small Chinese guy in a backpack and big glasses. And it was just beautiful. I mean, and I you know, we didn't have to work very hard on those pieces,
no.
Really. We just sat back in the van, you know, maybe tried to come up with a thing or two, but Dave would just spin that stuff out of nothing. And it was just...
It was amazing.
Just beautiful and amazing to watch. I think that would be a real highlight.
Yeah, I just got in from Brazil, and I'm looking for a nut store. I need to get into a nut store. Like, wait, what? Do you think they have cashews? Do they have cashews? It's like the weirdest.
Filberts.
Chocolate-covered
raisins.
One of the greatest ones ever was at one point we had two walkie-talkies, and we would go out with Rupert and this guy Leonard Teppert, who is this
God
weird,
rest his soul.
Yeah. Maybe him for the vice president for the movie.
Yeah.
But he was this round...
He was a homunculus. He looked like
Yeah, he was like Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
He looked like a Weeble. Like
a Weeble. Right? He was a perfectly round, bald guy.
So he would wobble, but he wouldn't fall down.
Yeah.
With a New York...
Actually, he did fall down.
He had a voice from like an old, like a... he sounded like Curly, sort of. Yeah. He was like one of the Three Stooges.
He was a character actor that we cast, and then we just started using him. But so we started going out with the two of them, and Dave had two walkie-talkies, and we you know... But there was one time, I think you were there for this, where they're sitting at a table at a restaurant, an outdoor restaurant. So the waitress comes over, and he's got both of them, right? So he's now... He's doing two microphones.
One that feeds to Rupert's ears,
and Dave is kind of almost doing Leonard's voice when he's talking to Leonard. So he's like, hey, do you have clams? Do you have clams? And he'd say, yeah, clams. Hey, Larry, you can't eat clams. You're allergic to clams. No, I'm not. But what was great is that at some point, I know we got a call. I'm wrapping this up. At some point, the waitress went away. And there was like a 30-minute period where Dave is just doing these two guys talking to each other. They work for us. Like, they're just sitting there. There's no more interaction with other people.
And they're just human puppets.
He's puppeting them.
Yes. Yeah. It's a radio play with human puppets. And he's just like, come on, Larry. I don't want to go to Florida. Why? I like Florida. I'm just like doing this. you don't use enough suntan lotion when we go to Florida. Yes, I do. You didn't put it on my back properly. Just creating this world. It was amazing. I have to go.
Now you're going to go because you have to get clips on it because you have a show that you have to make.
Well, yeah, we got the premiere. This is the big premiere that happened last night that was amazing.
Well, congratulations. It was a pleasure. It's so much fun hanging out.
Really fun meeting you.
Awesome.
When I come back, you know, we'll come on and you can come back on and we'll talk some more.
I love it. I'm a huge fan of the show, honestly. You guys do a great job. I listen religiously. It's great.
Well, thank you. President Pullman in 2016. Enjoy your Buttafuoco.
Buttafuoco!
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 65th National Finals of Distinguished Young Women.
Every year, one girl from every state leaves her family, her whole life behind, for 2 weeks and spends each day training, practicing, preparing. Because to win this competition, she needs to wow a panel of judges with her academic record, her athletic ability, her speaking skills, and a show-stopping talent.
I met her and I was like, she's gonna win.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
When I sing that song about being a black woman in America, there's gonna be backlash about that.
Oh, I'm just so happy. So happy.
I don't want to see them. I don't want to talk to them.
And then we stayed with them for the next year, unpacking just what happened those 2 weeks in Mobile. I'm Shimol Yai, and from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.